Session number 9211, real one.
Squadron Leader Curtis, Real One. Could you tell me when you joined the Royal Air Force and what were the circumstances?
Well, initially, when war broke out, I really wanted to join the Fleet Air Arm. And when I went for an interview in Birmingham, I think it was, I passed the medical and the other requirements, except for the fact that, strangely enough, the Navy said I didn't have enough teeth. Because, and this is quite true, the interviewing person said that in the Navy you ate hard tack and you haven't got enough teeth, which somewhat floored me because all I wanted to do was get involved. As a result of that, I walked round the corner and joined the Royal Air Force. This seems very strange to me in view of the fact that I wanted to join the Navy, obviously to get involved, presumably in fighting the German fleet, but instead of this, after joining the Royal Air Force, it seems very strange to me that that I helped to helped attack the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau and other units of the German fleet, including the Tirpitz, which I think you'll agree is rather strange and odd.
A poetic revenge.
Poetic revenge, yes. Sorry.
Do you think that you would have thought of joining the Fleet Air Arm or the Air Force if there hadn't been a war?
No. Definitely not. It's just the fact that it seemed the natural thing to do, to join up.
What was your civil occupation before you joined?
I didn't have one. I went straight from school. But I was hoping to read electronics or something connected with that at university, but instead of that, the war came along.
Was it that interest in electronics that led to your selection for wireless operator?
I should imagine that was probably something to do with it, because they knew which way I was heading. Although I didn't have any experience with radio or anything like that before I joined the Royal Air Force. But I can only guess that is the reason that the powers that be guided me in that direction.
Where did you do your signals training?
I was at Yatesbury in Wiltshire, which was a big shock to my constitution at that time. I think we had nothing but constant bad weather. This was in 1940, and it was there that I really did want to push ahead to become aircrew. All my friends seemed to join the Royal Air Force, and unfortunately, not one survived except me.
How were you selected for aircrew? Was it just a case of volunteering and being interviewed, or were there any practical tests?
No. I did volunteer, but that was probably as a result of being that people were asked if there were any volunteers for aircrew. I always remember my parachute training, because we were taken to a 5-barred gate, told to climb to the top of the gate, clutch our chest, jump off, count 5, and pretend to pull a cord. And that was it. That was the only training I ever had regarding parachute jumping. Luckily, I never had to make use of a parachute.
What sort of equipment were you trained on? What sort of radio equipment were you trained on?
The main thing that I remember was that I was instructed by an ex-naval telegraphist in the initial stages, and then went through various sessions daily of intensive Morse training, together with the trying to learn something about the basic electronics of radio, which seemed to come quite naturally and easily to me.
How long did this radio training take?
It took approximately 11 to 12 months. And it was a very intensive course, and despite the fact that the people who, says to myself, who wanted to get onto air crew were very impatient, the training appeared to be very thorough.
I think you say that from December 1940 onwards you were with 149 Squadron.
Well, I joined 149 Squadron at Mildenhall at the end of 1940, and for some reason immediately posted to 99 Squadron at Mildenhall. And from there, the whole squadron was transferred to Newmarket.
Was it from there that you did your raid on the Scharnhorst and Neisenau?
No, from memory, this was after we'd moved from Newmarket to Waterbeach in Cambridgeshire. As far as I can remember, that was the aerodrome from which we flew on that. An awful lot of the raids that I did against the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau when they were in dock at Brest did take place from Newmarket.
Were those all daylight raids?
No. The only daylight raid was the one when the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau broke out and went through the channel. All the others were night raids. In fact, from memory, I think we operated on one occasion four nights out of five at Brest, which was quite hard at the time.
Can you remember anything of the details about those night raids? How they went?
Well, the interesting thing about the early raids was that, especially over the Ruhr, when one seemed to be absolutely alone, the only way that we thought that we could find a target was when the blast furnaces or ovens in the Ruhr opened up, and you saw a glow in the sky, and you immediately peeled off and went for it. And when they heard you coming, they closed down, and then another one opened up, and you went after that. You knew you were in the Ruhr area. But navigation in those days was very, very difficult, very few radio aids, and one had to rely an awful lot on just sight alone, really, trying to find the targets. Very difficult. One of the interesting things about this... these raids on Brest was that we arrived over the target a little bit later than most of the people, and I think we were operating at about 8,000, 9,000 feet at that time, and somehow we finished up above the battleships at about a couple of hundred feet. And it was so many searchlights that you could actually see the camouflage netting over the ships, which was quite something. After that little episode, we shot up a little bit and landed at Farnborough, I think it was at that time. And that was another amusing instance, because the thing was pretty shot up, and the wheels were dangling down, as I remember, and the bomb doors were open. The hydraulic system had gone, and we did a sort of slithering landing right up against, well, when we got out of the aircraft, very quickly, I might add, it was a four-engine bomber. We'd never seen a four-engine bomber at that time. we took one look and ran like the devil. I don't quite know where we thought we were going, but it turned out to be a Stirling. Everybody thought it was hysterical except us.
On these early raids to the Ruhr, the night raids, what was your main function as a radio operator? What did you actually do when you were flying out to the target?
Mainly listening out, and also getting bearings if the navigator needed them. The basic requirement, as far as I could see, seemed to be a general listening out for instructions, possibly getting weather reports or things like this. I say the main thing was getting bearings to help the navigator.
How would you get a bearing? Would you have to request it, or would it just...
No, you could tune into to beacons and get a bearing. I don't think they were very accurate. Basically, getting fixes was a different thing, but then you had to contact stations back in England so you could get fixes on this by using a loop aerial. Here again, how accurate they were, I don't know. Navigator always seemed to think they were very inaccurate, but that may be because he was a bit inaccurate himself.
Did you have a general rule of radio silence?
Generally, yes. Yes, we did. Unless there were special occasions. In the early days, it very rarely happened. Very rarely happened. I think that in those early days, the function of a radio operator was to give to try to give the rest of the crew confidence that if we did ditch, we'd be able to get some signal back to base before we actually did. I know it was a matter of pride among navigators that they've tried very hard not to ask for bearings or fixes.
Did you find that the sets themselves were generally reliable?
Not really, no. In the early days it was a little bit hit or miss with them. The rains didn't seem to be too good. I know I can remember at certain times by seemingly having the set in bits on the floor, trying to coax by switching valves, etc., trying to coax a little bit more out of the set. But in the early days, not too good.
Were there any attempts to jam your radio in the early days?
Oh, yes. There were indeed. And, of course, we in turn tried to do various jamming of the German night fighters. How effective that was, I really and truly don't know. We were given certain frequencies with which to try to jam their signals. I have no idea whether they were effective or not.
When you were flying on such a raid, like a Ruhr raid or one of the night raids on Brest, did you have different frequencies for communication within the squadron and communication back to base?
No, not really. No, that was incorrect. We were given special frequencies to use, but of course one had also a permanent list of frequencies in case you got into difficulties where you could contact people very quickly.
On those early Ruhr raids, you said that it was often difficult to find the way unless you could see a blast furnace or some other source of light. Does that mean that on many occasions you had to jettison your bomb load or take them home?
No. Very rarely did one bring bombs back. There was always, if you couldn't find the target, there was always a German aerodrome somewhere where you could drop the things on. We tried very hard not to waste them.
Can you remember roughly what sort of proportion of raids did manage to find their way to the target in those early days?
Oh, basically, a surprisingly large amount. in those early days, we were taking photographs at night, and we had very few complaints that we hadn't actually found the target. The main problem with finding the target, of course, was weather. This was the main problem. Often we used to set off on beautiful moonlight nights, which were the best if it was moonlight, obviously, over there. But by the time you'd reach the target, the cloud had come down often to 8, 9, sometimes 10 tenths cloud, and then it was very difficult. But you usually had an alternative target to aim for.
Was it easier to find Brest?
Yes, it was, for obvious reasons. You came approached from the coast and it would stood out like a sore thumb. Very easy.
Now, you said that your hydraulics had gone when you came back from one of the raids on Brest. Mm-hmm. Was that a result of flak? Or?
Yes, that was flak. The reason that we got down so low over this aircraft on this occasion was that, as I said before, we seemed to be over there on our own. We were later than the rest of the force, which wasn't very big, of course, in those days. And we got hammered really hard, and I think with the pilot taking violent evasive action, we gradually got lower and lower and lower. But he was a very determined pilot, and kept going. But even after we dropped the bombs from a reasonable height, we still kept round, going round and round and round, trying to get away from the searchlights and flak. But in fact, it got that bad at one stage. But I know the air gunners were attempting, in fact, did shoot out a lot of searchlights around there. I think it was the searchlights that enabled us to see the ship so clearly when we were so low down. But light flak was the thing that did all the damage on that occasion. In fact, light flak was the thing that I think most aircrew feared more than anything, because you could see the darn stuff, the traces coming up, and whereas the heavy thing, all you heard really was a big crump and sometimes a flash.
On balance, again, referring mainly to those early days, which was the most dangerous, the night fighter or the flak?
Well, the flak. Night fighters were very few and far between in those days. We were attacked, I think, on my first tour twice by night fighters, but they didn't hit us. And if we did see one, we kept very quiet about it and hoped he would go away. One occasionally saw little battles going on. You could see the tracer going in the sky. But when this happened, one tended to keep very well away. We were very scared of night fighters. But I think that probably more scared than we really should have been, possibly. But the flak was very good, very accurate, and quite intensive.
Could you tell me a bit more about the daylight raid on the Scharnhorst and the Meisenau? How did that come about and what happened?
Well, this was this came about when they broke out of Brest. And although the weather was exceedingly bad, as I remember, we took off, and stooged around doing square searches for long enough. I think we saw the battleships once through cloud, but didn't get a chance to attack it. Although they, from what I remember, they certainly attacked us.
Was it just your squadron that was involved in that effort, as far as you know?
No. To the best of my knowledge, there were other squadrons involved at the same time.
Did you have a fighter escort on that
no.
occasion?
No, certainly not. No.
Did you do other daylight raids at all at this stage?
No. No, that was the only one in which I took part.
I think you were flying in Wellingtons at that time.
That's right.
What was the Wellington like to as an aircraft to fly in?
Excellent. Very, very strong, very reliable. Crews basically loved it. One felt as secure in the Wellington, if you could feel secure at all while flying against over there, than possibly any other aircraft that I've flown in. I don't know why, but it just everybody just seemed to like the Wellington.
Was it a comfortable aircraft to fly in?
Well, no aircraft during the war really comfortable. I mean, I seem to spend my time curled in a semi-ball all the time. I always swear this is why I never... When I joined the Air Force, I was 5 feet ten, and when I came out, I was 5 feet ten. Or 5 feet nine and a half, I'm not quite sure which. But not really, no.
How did the Wellington compare with other aircraft you flew in for comfort, reliability and handling?
Well, the only problem that we had on in the aircraft in which I flew on 99 Squadron was with engines. We tended to get engines overheat quite a bit. But apart from that, a very good, reliable aeroplane. Compared with, say, Whitley, that I flew in, felt happier in the Wellington than in the Whitley. Felt happier than in the Wellington and the Whitley than in Halifax's, which I thought was a dreadful aeroplane. Not everyone will agree with that, of course. But I suppose the finest aircraft I ever flew in, of course, was the Lancaster, without any shadow of a doubt.
What was wrong with the Halifax, from your point of view?
Well, as far as the... I found that a very uncomfortable aeroplane. I felt that... I never felt secure in a Halifax for some reason. It had the same engines as the Lancaster. But the... I had one or two nasty experiences in Halifaxes. I know that on one raid over Berlin, on my second tour or wherever it was, we were under pretty heavy punishment from flak, and the aircraft literally flopped over and went down in a sort of almost an inward... inward loop, if you can imagine the thing. All the time screaming like one of these American Air Force pictures that one saw. But not a comfortable aircraft. Not a comfortable aircraft.
So the Wellington was better at absorbing punishment, was it, than the Halifax?
Excellent, yes. I mean, well, I can't... I'm no expert on that, but all I know is that... the Wellingtons on the squadron used to come back pretty wholly, if that's the right way of putting it, and but still staggered on, and one always felt you could get back in a Wellington.
Now, you said the Lancaster was the best of all. What advantages did the Lancaster have over the Wellington?
Well, it had four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, which gave us an awful sense of confidence. From a wireless operator's point of view, it was a nice warm aircraft because the wireless operator controlled the heating on the thing. It could absorb an awful lot of punishment. It could fly very high, and it could carry a very big bomb load. It was a, although not I'm not a pilot, I have flown them, and it was an airman's aircraft. Airmen will know what I mean by that, I'm sure.
Did you fly in any other types besides those we just mentioned?
I Let's see, if Wellingtons, Whitleys, Halifaxes, Lancasters. Yes, I did, but only testing. This was on 617 Squadron. I did quite a lot of testing in mosquitoes, because there was a thought at one stage that rather than have Lancasters going in low level to mark targets, and as signals leader I was in charge of the signals operation on the squadron, the powers that be wondered if the job could be better performed by a mosquito with a wireless operator, presumably, with possibly a little bit of navigation training, doing the function that in a mosquito rather than in a Lancaster, which logically did make sense. But I found that it was very, very difficult indeed, particularly when the pilots started doing low-level aerobatics to operate the set correctly. Whether the pilot was just trying it on or not, I don't know, but I did find it very difficult if you were in a mosquito, because you were very cramped.
Did it feel safe to you, the mosquito?
Oh, yes. I say the only aircraft that I flew in, and I include ferry battles in the big when in my initial training, the only aircraft I ever felt uncomfortable in was the Halifax.
Now, you're saying you'd flown aircraft,
mm-hmm.
but you weren't a trained pilot.
That's right.
How is it that you were able to fly aircraft?
Well, I had some very understanding pilots and air crews. Certain pilots believed that, and rightly so, I think, that if they got hit, it made sense for some other member of the crew to take over the aircraft, at least to fly it more or less straight and level, rather than no one being able to take over at all. I found this, frankly, with all...